Bring it. It's coming, Ralph. It's coming. Fun is on the way.
Right.
All right, Lucy. I like that. Tony. Tony's ready to have fun, Bill.
Okay.
He was quick with that.
Oh, yeah. Here we go, Lindsay. I love you all. You're great. Hey, Bill, I bet you the participants in your training are nowhere near as fun as this.
Probably not, no.
All right. Well, Patrick, let us know. Congratulations, all of you who were early joiners. Lisa, you're cracking me up here. Oh man, this is good hype for the show, Bill. I like this. This is fun. I'm getting excited already. Here we go. So, Patrick, are we ready to start the show?
Yes, I think we are. Well, hello everyone, and welcome to our sixth episode of Fun with the Far. My name is Patrick Hallshaw, your Fun with the Far producer, and I'm joined today by our amazing host, Steve, and our special guest, Bill Hardy. So before we begin, I do have a couple of housekeeping announcements. During the episode, I'll be giving out three passwords that will pop up on the screen and that will be announced. These passwords are necessary if you're seeking CLE, CLP, or CPE credit. To get the credit, please write the passwords down. Now, once the session is over, please log into the PCI website and you will see a survey with instructions on how to get credit under My Certificates and Courses. Make sure you fill out the survey in order to get credit for the program. And if a password or poll is not available under My Certificates or Courses, you can submit your passwords to either Ophelia or Danny at publiccontractinginstitute.com. And additionally, there may be polling questions for your participation records. And we do encourage all questions and comments which may be submitted in the chat. And if you have any technical difficulties, don't hesitate to let me know. Just a quick reminder that moving forward, we will be hosting a pre-show 10 minutes prior to the start of each episode. Of course, attendance is not mandatory, but we will be having fun conversations and trivia. And with that, I will pass it on to Bill and Steve.
Thank you, Patrick, and welcome all. Yeah, for those of you who jumped in right before the start of the show, we are having a little bit of fun with our early joiners. So come on in. The water is fine. We'd love to have you, but we know that your time is precious. So it's not required. Well, we're going to have fun for the next hour and a half with you all and my good, great guest, Bill Hardy, who I've known for many, many years.
25.
Bill, I'm thrilled that you're with me again this year.
Yeah.
In season 10, our decade of fun.
Yes.
Welcome.
Thanks, Steve.
If you could very briefly, mm-hmm. very briefly, give us some background on your involvement in government contracts and then tell us why you picked government contracts as a profession.
Good question, Steve. So I've been involved with government contracts for 40 years and started out in the aerospace business and then transitioned from, I started out in subcontracts or purchasing, then subcontracts, and eventually got into contracts because I like dealing with the client and directly with the program office and the program managers. And I've been, when I work with Steve, like at least, I don't know, 15 years ago, Steve. It's like, that's almost
1996, I believe, Bill.
Yeah. So it's been a long time. But we worked for a government contractor in the DC area, and it's been a wild ride. And then Steve asked me to join him at PricewaterhouseCoopers. So we went there, and that was a much different experience in government contracting because they took their commercial practice and decided to go into government contracting. And they didn't really know much about it, and they thought they could manage the government and tell them, here's what you need to do. And it didn't work out that way. So we had to teach them a lot about government contracts.
A lot of training, Bill.
A lot of training, yes, that's right, to explain to them the difference between commercial contracting and government contracting. So, and I'm currently at UIC Government Services. They're Alaska Native Corporation. Our headquarters is in Anchorage, Alaska, but our government division is in Springfield, Virginia. And I have 31 people that work for me in contracts, subcontracts, purchasing, compliance, and government property all report to me. So it's a pretty large organization, and we've over the last four years we've grown incredibly large. So we got a lot of challenges.
Right. And Bill, one of the reasons why I love having you participate on this particular episode is because of your vast knowledge, but more importantly, you give us a different perspective.
Yeah.
Bill is not a lawyer. He's not an accountant. He is a contracts professional like many of us. So I like the fact, Bill, that a lot of the conversation we're going to have today is about what it's like to be in the trenches.
Yeah.
What is it like to actually deal with some of these regulations that we're going to talk about today?
Right.
And also for all of you out there, I'm going to set up a little preview. Bill and I are thinking about putting together a program for PCI that we're going to call In the Trenches. Mm-hmm. And we're going to pick topics that we think fairly narrow topics that we're going to get feedback from some of you or whoever wants to participate on a, you know, maybe a 10 episode program where we're going to talk about something specific and more importantly, not only talk about the issue or the problem, but also kind of discuss potential solutions and right. maybe solutions that work.
Yeah.
So at the end of the show, we'd love to get some feedback with you with regard to whether you think Bill and I should be doing this type of class, whether it's something you might be interested in.
Let me give them a sample.
Without further ado, we're going to start this episode like we do all other episodes. We're going to do a review okay. of the topics that we talked about 2 weeks ago. Now, you can play along if you so choose, but don't shout out the answer before it's given. All right, so Patrick, let's jump into those review questions.
You see it on your screen? This one should be up.
I do. Which of the following is not a mandatory source identified in FAR Part 8? Is it A, the federal prisons industry? B, the Committee for Purchase from People Who Are Blind or Severely Disabled? C, the GSA stock program, or D, the GSA federal supply schedule program? Which of the following is not a mandatory source identified in FAR Part 8? All right, people are jumping around. Let's give people another minute. We're getting close. Come on, I know there's more than 53 of you out there. Come join in. Everything's anonymous, so I don't know who's giving which response, so there's no reason to be fearful. All right, let's close the poll. All right. The correct answer, of which one quarter of you got correct, is D, the GSA Federal Supply Schedule Program. That is not a mandatory source identified in FAR Part 8. It's identified, but Bill, we all know that the government's not required to use FAR Part 8
right.
to procure commercial items. There's other ways to do that, including using a FAR Part 12 type contract. So the correct answer is D, the GSA Federal Supply Schedule Program. And at the beginning, the answer can be found at the beginning of FAR Part 8. Okay. I've got a technical issue on my end here. Is the poll loading for question? All right, question number two. Where are GSA schedule task orders publicized? Is it A, the government-wide point of entry? Is it B, GSA eBuy? Is it C, GSA Advantage? Or is it D, all of the above? Now, Bill, I know you know the answer to this question.
Yeah.
Where are GSA scheduled task orders publicized? All right, let's close the poll. The correct answer, Bill, is?
D.
What's that?
D as in dog.
No.
The
correct answer is B.
Oh.
B as in boy.
Okay.
Contracting officers are specifically told in FAR Part 8 not to use the government point of entry, government-wide point of entry.
Okay.
GSA Advantage Bill, the government doesn't use that system to issue RFQs. GSA Advantage is the catalog. So therefore, yeah. D is not correct.
You're right.
The correct answer is B, GSA E-Buy.
E-Buy.
B is a boy. So 8% of you got that correct. All right, next question. All right, up to what point in time is a contracting officer able to use previously conducted market research in a task order or delivery order procurement issued under an IDIQ contract? This is a question about how often the government needs to do market research and when they can rely up on a prior procurement. You probably don't know the answer to this, Bill, because you weren't with us 2 weeks ago.
No. But I do know we get market research questions all the time. They go into SAM and they buy our NAICS code, and then they're looking for small business and small disadvantage, which we have those in our company.
For that. Absolutely.
Yep. So they'll reach out to me and they'll ask me if we'd be interested in receiving a request for information or sources sought. And of course we always say yes. and then we respond to those. That's their market research.
All right. So let's close the poll. The correct answer here is B, within 18 months. So in your case, Bill, if the government called you today about what your capabilities are for a particular procurement,
right,
they might be able to use that same information 18 months from now, and it wouldn't be considered stale.
Got it.
They can rely upon that. But after 18 months, they'd have to come back and maybe have another conversation with you and your organization.
Right.
All right. So next question. All right, this is talking about Section 508, Bill. Mm-hmm. Which of the following is considered EIT, Electronic Information Technology, under Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1973? Is it A, computer software? Is it B, internet development services? Is it C, computer hardware? Or is it D, all of the above? We did a lot of this work, Bill, when we worked together at Computer Data Systems Inc. We had a lot of contracts that had Section 508 requirements.
Right. I think I know the answer to this one, Steve.
I hope you know the answer to this, Bill.
Yes.
All right, the poll is closed, and the answer is?
D is in dog, Steve.
D is in dog, all of the above, all of the above. It also includes, Bill, telecommunications equipment.
Correct.
Yeah. Right? The government has a procurement for telecommunications equipment. It needs to make sure that it seeks sources that can comply with Section 508. Now, one of the things that we had a conversation about, Bill, 2 weeks ago, is if you are providing computer hardware or providing computer software, you need to make a certification as to whether it is or isn't compliant with Section 508 in your in your proposal. Merely saying it's not compliant might not mean you're not going to win that award. But if someone says they can, more often than not, you're going to be found non-compliant. The important thing is not to gild the lily and maybe say, oh, this is not really, this certification is not important. The government, if the, you provide a false certification to the government and you win that contract award, you will be subject to potential civil and criminal sanctions. And you don't want to do that. If you are not compliant, what you're capable of doing in your proposal is to say, I might not be fully compliant. You might not fulfill all 15 or 20 of the items of compliance, but you might have 15. And you talk to the given. The important thing is that your information you provide the government is correct. If you're a federal government contractor and you're providing a service to the government, Section 508 doesn't say that the hardware that you use as a contractor that's not being delivered needs to be Section 508 compliant. But Bill, today, if you have the computer on your desk right now, whether it's a laptop, whether it's a desktop, pretty much all manufacturers, major manufacturers, already provide a Section 508 compliant product. Right. And in fact, more often than not, if you went to the website on the specifications, it would probably identify that it is compliant. And again, the reason for that, Bill, is because of the power of the government as a buyer.
Right.
Right. If the government sets a standard, more often than not, contractors are going to follow that standard, because especially if they want to do business with the federal government.
Right.
And in this case, Section 508 allows, has caused contractors to create and develop software, hardware, telecommunications equipment, the certain websites that are fully accessible to people with disabilities.
Yeah.
So again, the benefits that is provided by our federal government as a buyer. All right, Patrick, next question. Or I think it might be the last one.
Yeah, that was the that was the fourth and final.
Okay, great, fantastic. All right, so Bill, are you ready to go?
I am, Steve.
All right, are all you ready to go? Just so you know, we are going to open up the mics to the extent you might want to talk with us. Without further ado, Bill, let's talk first about FAR Part 4.
Okay.
Which the FAR Council has entitled Administrative Matters. And when we look at FAR Part 4,
hey, Steve, you need to unmute. You're muted.
Not anymore.
I think you are as well, Bill.
Yeah, something happened. We went
for some reason
there.
We got muted. All right, so 4.000 tells us that this part prescribes policies and procedures relating to the administrative aspects of contract execution, contractor submitted paper documents, distribution, reporting, retention, and files. Bill, we're talking about nitty-gritty stuff, down in the trenches stuff that are very, very important. It's not sexy, it's not glamorous, FAR Part 4, but nonetheless, it's important information that we all need to know, whether we're on the buy side or if we're on the sell side.
Right.
As a general nature, Bill, government contracts is detailed oriented and very bureaucratic.
Extremely. Oh, extremely, Steve. It's gotten
absolutely
worse.
And more importantly, when we're dealing with the federal government, it's important that we understand what the requirements are and that we fully comply with them. Because not complying with them, Bill, what are some adverse consequences for not complying, other than civil sanctions and criminal sanctions?
Debarment, Steve.
Well, debarment, it could mean we're not helping our government customer out.
Right.
Right? If the government customer says, I need this, and a contractor doesn't fully provide what's needed, the contracting officer's got to come back and say, you did it wrong. Do it again.
Right.
That causes delay. That causes frustration. It could lead to a performance report at the end of the year saying this contractor is very difficult to work with, yeah, which could lose, could cause you to lose future contracts and future revenue.
Yeah.
So when Bill and I are having this conversation about FAR Part 4, this is important stuff. And I'm glad you're all joining us to understand some of these topics. The first major topic that's addressed in FAR Part 4, Bill, of course, is contract execution, which we all love to receive that contract award notice.
Yes. Right? Yep.
And the FAR Council tells contracting officers and it tells government contractors that the only person who can sign an awarded contract on behalf of the government is a contracting officer. And we talked, Bill, in our conversation in FAR Part 1 about the fact that the contracting officer needs to have a sufficient warrant authority.
Right. Absolutely.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I would guess, Bill, that the presumption that the contracting officer who's identified in the solicitation, mm-hmm, a contractor can rely upon the fact that if that person is identified in the solicitation, they have the proper warrant authority.
Correct.
Now, as a general rule, the contracting officer signs an awarded contract second, after the contractor has signed it. After the contractor has signed it. The one exception to that general rule, Bill, of course, is a response to an RFQ, mm-hmm, a request for quote.
Right.
When the government decides who will be awarded a task order or a delivery order under a competitive indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity contract, like the federal supply schedule,
right,
that we talked about 2 weeks ago, the contracting officer will have already signed the awarded task order or delivery order. And in that instance, the contractor signs second. Now, Bill, as a contractor, when you receive a signed delivery order or a signed task order by the contracting officer, or in the case of a non-IDIQ contract award for a task order, delivery order, and you received just the contract or that the government has sent to you for your signature or your, mm-hmm, company's signature, what's the normal process for that?
So for us, we have a pretty rigorous process. It's received by my contracts managers and they review it and they send it out to our finance department, our billing department, the program manager. Sometimes they'll include the pricer and they'll look through different aspects of the contracts, and we often find errors. And so we'll go back before we sign it and we'll bring the errors to their attention in rare situations. But typically when they're at the end of the fiscal year, you'll get an email back and says, we agree to make these corrections, but please sign it, move forward. And we will do that. But that's our process, just to make sure that contract, before we sign it, is accurate and correct. And then before we put it through our setup and cost point.
Now, one of the significance of the contractor signature is they are accepting the terms and conditions in the document that they've received.
Right.
So in Bill's description of his scenario, if the contractor simply signs the contract or signs the task order or signs the delivery order and sends it back to the government, that's deemed accepted. If 2 days later, Bill, you look at it and go, oh my God, there's something wrong in this contract.
Right.
Okay. The bottom line is The government can say, too bad, too bad, too sad.
Right.
You've agreed to it.
Yes.
You have agreed to this contract.
Yep.
It is important. It is important for contractors to review the documents that you receive from the government when it comes to an awarded contract, task order, or delivery order.
Right.
The other issue that arises is there's another way for a contractor to indicate acceptance, Bill. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about this in the past. If the government starts work,
yeah,
they don't sign anything, but they actually start work. Starting work is acceptance of the contract that you have received.
Yeah.
Now, I have seen situations, Bill, and we've lived through this together.
Yes.
Where the government has sent us a contract. We have found errors in that contract. The government has told us that we will make those corrections, but starting work is very, very important.
Yes.
In that instance, it is important for the contractor to make sure that agreement is somewhere in writing.
Correct.
With the contracting officer.
Yeah.
That our starting work is conditioned upon the acceptance of the corrections that we identified in email dated XYZ or what have you.
Yeah.
You want to make it very clear, because the bottom line is, if the government doesn't make those corrections, technically your work would stop, and the government would have to pay you for that work that you've performed. Mm-hmm. But going forward, or you can say, we agree to perform work with the understanding that the work is subject to the corrections.
Yeah. I had that happen last week, Steve. We received a draft contract, and we reviewed it, and we found some issues with it. And they said, but we need to have you start today, basically, as soon as you got this award. So we agreed to do that. And we often get contracts on Fridays, and they want us to start on Monday. So it you really have to have a process down where you just document it in an email and get them to say, yes, I acknowledge this, and I'll fix it on the next mod, or better if they can fix it on the contract before you sign it. But that usually time is of the essence, and so they want you to sign it and move on.
But there are workarounds, but the important thing is that you get the workarounds memorialized in writing, and that you've got acceptance from the contracting officer,
right,
who has authority to agree to that workaround. But there is a way for you to do that. Now, Bill, FAR Part 4.102 talks about who signs for the contractor.
Mm-hmm.
And it identifies individuals. If the individual is a contractor, if a partnership is a contractor, if a corporation is a contractor, if a joint venture is a contractor, or if it's signed by the agent. Mm-hmm. When it comes to a partnership, Bill and I both work for PricewaterhouseCoopers.
All right.
The partnership, that contract, Bill, that's signed is in the name of the partnership. Now, the best practice that we had in place at PricewaterhouseCoopers is we would have PricewaterhouseCoopers on the acceptance line, but we would also buy a named partner.
Yes.
And the reason for that is it provided the government with actual notice as to who was signing on behalf of the contractor. But more importantly, we were able to identify who that person was and the authority that they had been granted by the partnership in a partnership agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And the FAR Council tells COs, you are required to take some steps, take some due diligence to understand who the person is who signed that. And more importantly, also to have evidence that that person who signed it has authority. Now, when it comes to a corporation, Bill, like the Alaska Native Corporation that you currently work for.
Right.
Who signs Bowhead's contracts?
So I have a delegation from our vice president of UIC Government Services, delegates down to me, and then I delegate down to my contracts managers. And so depending on the dollar authority, they're able to sign the contract. And if it exceeds their delegation, then I end up signing the contracts. And it's clearly stated in our cover letter that when we submit our proposal, who has authority to sign on the contract. And I usually sign the cover sheet when we submit our proposal. So it's real clear on our side.
And that's a great point, Bill. Identifying who has authority on behalf of the contractor in this, in the actual proposal that you submit, is a great best practice.
Yeah.
But the bottom line, in that instance, when it's a corporation, again, the contracting officer has a requirement to do some due diligence. Joint ventures has to be signed by all of the companies that have formed the joint venture. So if Lockheed Martin entered into a joint venture agreement, Bill, with UIC government or Bowhead, and you had a JV agreement in place, because a joint venture is subject to an agreement, both Lockheed Martin's name, and also a buy, because they're a corporation. So an individual with authority from Lockheed Martin would sign on behalf of the JV, and the same thing with regard to UIC government or Bowhead. Again, it's a corporation that is entered into. So in that instance, Bowhead or UIC government by someone with authority to sign for the joint venture.
Correct.
Again, very, very important. The reason why there's all these authority rules as far as who's going to sign is the government needs to protect itself from a company or a partnership or a joint venture to come back and say, well, we didn't agree to that. We didn't agree to that because the person who signed it didn't have authority. So it's important that the bottom line is that you understand who has authority. And after the government has done that due diligence, Bill, then the contracting officer would sign on behalf of the government, right? Not in their personal capacity, but in their official capacity.
Right. Steve, we could hop in and do that first password.
Sure.
Perfect. So our first password of the day is Weller, B-U-E-L-L-E-R, Weller. All right.
I would pronounce it Bueller.
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 Bueller. Bueller.
Bueller. Bueller.
Okay.
You'd have to
say now, Bill. 4.2 talks about distribution that the government has to follow. Again, very, very detailed, nitty gritty nuts and bolts. The government, the CO, has responsibility to issue and distribute the awarded contract documents within 10 working days to all of the parties who need to understand that a contract has just been awarded. Most importantly, back to the contractor, right, Bill?
Right.
Because the bottom line is you're waiting.
Yes.
Right? Contractors don't start work until you get that signed contract.
Correct in most cases. Right? Yes, that's right. You don't want to start work until it's a done deal. You're right.
And the reason why is that, Bill?
Because otherwise you're at risk. They could somehow change their mind or something unforeseen happen, and you know, you don't want to be at risk. That's the thing. So,
well, here's the interesting thing, Bill. The government could send it to the contractor. Mm-hmm. The contractor accepts it. They send it back to the government. The government can say, whoops.
Yeah, they made a mistake.
We found a mistake.
Yes, that's right.
Right? There's a dollar discrepancy. We didn't mean to put those dollars in that contract.
Yeah.
Right? They might come back and tell the contractor, oh, by the way, we're amending that contract. We're sending back your new contract because we have identified a mistake. You don't want to start work without that signed contract.
Yeah.
And you most definitely, Bill, don't want to start work if you simply have been notified orally that you've won.
Correct. That's all.
Bill and I lived through that. Yeah, Bill and I were in a situation where our client was so excited. Oh, we've been notified of award. They started work.
Yes, that's true.
They started work. They started billing time. And of course, the contracting officer, when looked at these timesheets, said, well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Why are you submitting bills for time that was set before we even started the contract? That's a risk that you should try to avoid, especially if the contracting officer doesn't know you're going to do that.
Yes.
Okay. Next topic, Patrick. Next slide.
Yeah.
All right. Safeguarding classified information pops up at 4.4. If we could pull up a quick poll, how many of you out there work for a company or are a government employee who works with classified contracts? FAR Part 4 doesn't give you a 4.4 doesn't give a lot of details. And that's probably a good thing, Bill.
Probably.
Because the number or percentage of contractors that deal with classified information is fairly small.
All right.
And in fact, it's a very close-knit group of companies to some extent. If you can get a classified contract, it leads to more classified contracts, which, Bill, we talked about with competition requirements and sole source awards. The government often has an opportunity to award on a sole source basis classified contracts.
Right.
And a lot of companies often will say, well, Steve, what's the best way for me to get a classified contract, or more importantly, have an opportunity to have my facility cleared? And of course, you can't have people cleared until you have a facility clearance. My response is it's often done through subcontracts, that you have found a prime contractor that is cleared, and that you have an opportunity to, because you're about to work on a classified contract, opportunity to have your facility cleared, which leads to having your people cleared. There are three classifications: confidential, secret, top secret. And a subcategory of top secret is SCI, sensitive compartmental information. Those levels of clearance. Each level of clearance requires more requirements, of course, that have need to be complied with. We haven't got yet, Bill, to talk about standard safeguards, but we will talk about standard cybersecurity safeguards.
Okay.
That contractors often forget they need to comply with, because they say we're not working under a classified contract, but nonetheless, the government has said there are certain safeguards you need to put into place for purposes of work you're performing for the federal government. And those requirements, Bill, are growing. And we're gonna talk about that a little bit later.
Yeah.
If you have a classified contract, you will be subject to what's called the National Industrial Security Program Operating Manual, the NISPOM. And it's important that you comply with all those requirements, because once you get a clearance, you never want to lose it. The most important document that you will receive as a classified contractor, and Bill, it's interesting, 71% have a company, are working for a company that has classified contracts, or they're a government official who is working with classified contracts. The most important document in a classified contract, from my perspective, is what's known as the DD-254. And that's it's a form, it's part of your contract that will identify what your level of your clearance you need to comply with,
right,
how you can create, store, and distribute information under your federal government classified contract, and will often identify subcontractors who are authorized to work under your prime classified prime contract. Very, very important document. And Bill, I'll often tell classified contractors that I've worked with in the past that I don't know, for some reason, there often are mistakes in your DD-254.
Really?
And it's important, again, to make sure that that information is correct.
Yeah.
Because of course you don't want to work under an assumption that you have, that you're working under a particular type of contract and the government has a different idea. You want to make sure that there's a meeting of the minds with regard to what your requirements are. And again, it's because you don't want to lose a clearance.
Yeah. So Steve, most of our facilities have a SCIF, and it's a very expensive process to get a facility clearance. And we have our security department. We have four people that work in there, and their job is to make sure all those documents are correct and making sure that our people are following the rules. And we have a lot of tight controls on that.
And it's important that training your employees is critical. Mm-hmm. Making sure that you have the proper facilities, like a SCIF, Bill, if you're going to be storing documents in your contractor site.
Yeah.
If you're going to be creating documents in your contractor site, you need to make sure that you have proper IT equipment. And you're certainly telling your employees, please do not take documents out of the SCIF and take them home.
You mean like the president, Steve?
I don't want to talk about politics, Bill.
But
the bottom line is, and I'm sure the 71% of you who have some familiarity with classified information, as government contracts professionals, we know classified information should never leave a government facility or a contractor secured facility for any reason.
Yes.
4.5, Bill, electronic commerce, right? I remember back in the day, in the early to mid 90s, maybe the late, beginning around the late 80s, computers became more frequently used. My first job at the Pentagon, Bill, everything was written on a typewriter. Now it was an electric typewriter, thankfully.
Yeah.
But all of our contract documents were written on forms with a electric typewriter. I never even touched a computer when I worked at the Pentagon back in the early to mid 80s. And I remember when 4.5 came out, electronic commerce, because I remember when we first started working together, Bill, the question was, well, can we send the government an email and have it be considered an accepted contract communication? Because there were all these words in the FAR, there were all these words in the contract that referred to copy, talked about, you know, wet ink signatures. So there was a big to-do when the FAR Council finally decided, you know what, we need to have rules that state that yes, using electronic commerce is okay on the buy side, but also on the sell side. Mm-hmm. What the FAR Council does say though, is you need to make sure that your systems are able to authenticate that the documents or signatures that are received or sent, and that how you maintain electronic copies are sufficient. And all those rules with regard to maintaining electronic copies of hard paper documents are set forth in 4.5. I remember, Bill, talking to IT departments for companies that we worked for and asking them to make sure that they could check the box for all the requirements that are in 4.5 to make sure that our systems could allow us to digitize our contracts documents so we didn't have to store paper everywhere.
Right.
And we actually had a situation where the government was concerned about how we were storing documents. They wanted to make sure that there was some chain of custody with regards to how we kept our documents. And we were able to demonstrate to them, yes, we went through the checklist. We had someone from DCMA come in. We walked them through how we maintained and stored our electronic documents, how we were able to authenticate digitized documents to hard copy documents. And it was a great success. The most important new rule bill that popped up was with regard to electronic signatures, which was great for submitting solicitations, which was great for contract award documents. And that's found at 4.502 D as in David.
Right.
The government made very clear, yes, the government is able to accept electronic signatures. Because believe it or not, back in the day, not so long ago, yeah. Although now, you know, 35, 40 years ago, the government specifically said signatures must be, I can't recall, Bill, whether it was black or blue. I think it was a blue.
Yeah, blue, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they used to call it a wet signature. Wet signature.
Right.
Because the government, and the reason why is because the government would lick their thumb, scrape across it, and if it smeared, then that was an authenticated signature.
Yeah. Steve, I remember when we used to send.
Days are over, Bill.
Yeah, me too. See, we used to send our documents via fax, and then we had to FedEx them with the wet signatures. And I kept saying, wow, this is crazy, and it's a lot of money. So we were certainly glad when they finally said that facsimiles were acceptable with for signatures.
All right, Bill, let's, Patrick, next slide. Let's talk about FPDS, the Federal Procurement Data System. Tell us what it is, and how does Bowhead utilize FPDS?
So the Federal Procurement Data System is the repository that has all the opportunities and contract information in there. So we, our BD guys use that, not entirely, but that's a good starting point. They look at previous contracts that are awarded, and they can see who is it awarded to. And they also use GovWin. We subscribe to GovWin, although lately I think we've decided that GovWin doesn't give us enough information. So we also look at agency websites. And now that kind of past COVID a bit, we are starting to go back to in-person contractor meetings where the government will have industry days. And our BD guys can actually go there and listen to what the government is planning on issuing as far as solicitations. And so it's a kind of a combination then is what we use, Steve.
Contractors, good contractors, like UIC and Bowhead, use FPDS as a wonderful business intelligence tool. Because it's a fully searchable database.
Right.
And you're able to identify agencies that have purchased a particular product or service in the past. You have an opportunity to do a search for agencies that have procured a certain product or service and the amount of money that they spent for that product or service.
Yeah.
You're able to identify small businesses who provide products or services to the government. If you're a large business, you can use FPDS, Bill, as a potential tool to find or help you meet your small business subcontracting goals.
Yeah.
It's a powerful tool.
Right.
And I would have to say, Bill, if you are a young contracts professional and you master the ability to use FPDS, that is a wonderful skill to have and makes you valuable.
Sure.
Whether you're on the government buy side or whether you're on the government or contractor sell side, the government uses FPDS as a market research tool. Again, to identify contractors who have sold products or services in the past. It'll inform you as to the type of contract that either your agency or other agencies have used to buy a particular product or service. Very, very powerful. Very, very powerful tool. Bill, FPDS is kind of like the official contract reporting depository. And it's important. It's a very powerful tool we talked about. But often there are mistakes. You might do, matter of fact, what I often will tell contractors, if you haven't, run a report on your own company and see what's actually in FPDS. And you want to make sure that information is correct. Because again, it will be used by the government for other purposes. For those of you who have federal supply schedule contracts, Bill, I'm presuming, Bill, there are still folks who are coming in and doing assist visits for purposes of GSA compliance.
Yeah, we had one last year.
And what I found, again, when Bill and I were working together, is the GSA, they don't call themselves auditors.
No.
They actually use FPDS to identify your GSA schedule task orders and delivery orders by value. And we'll actually use FPDS as a way to identify the universe of contracts that they might like to request to review during their assist visit. And again, it's important that information that you have that's in FPDS is correct, because it might impact dollar thresholds. It might impact what exactly is being sold. If you are a company who's interested in buying another federal government contractor, Bill, FPDS is a wonderful tool.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because it will identify, again, for the buyer, while they're doing due diligence, as to find out, well, what are the dollar values of currently existing contracts? What type of contracts are they working under? What customers are they currently providing goods and services to? There's a multiple different reasons why FPDS is important, both again for the buyer side and the sell side. One of the most important parts in FAR Part 4, Bill, is the information and guidance that a contractor receives with regard to how long they should keep their documents, the retention periods.
Right.
And those are found at FAR Part 4.7. Again, very nitty gritty rules.
Yeah.
Right. Document retention policies, Bill.
Yep.
Or UIC government push down?
Yes.
Record retention policies or procedures to the government contracting operating entity?
Yes, Steve. It's become even more important. So when you had paper files, you used to use like Iron Mountain to store your documents and, you know, out of sight, out of mind. So some companies I've worked for would put documents there and then nobody ever thought like, oh, how old are those documents? You definitely want to destroy them at a certain point of after you've closed the contract out, like within 3 years after you close the contract out, because otherwise the government can come back and ask for those. I've never had that actually happen. But now, Steve, with everything, we've gone almost to 100% electronic files. Now it's all about storage in the cloud. It's very expensive, and we're trying to develop a policy of how to go through our documents in the cloud to destroy those, because we want to reduce or keep our costs for storage in the cloud down. It's
right.
Our budget this year is a lot larger than it was 2 or 3 years ago.
And the bottom line, Bill, with regard to the cloud, not only is you're throwing it up to the cloud, but you're throwing it up to a cloud service provider.
Yeah.
Who is probably charging more for your service than they would for a commercial service, because again, the government has tacked on additional cybersecurity requirements. Correct. On top of that.
Yep.
The important rule is with regard to contractor record retention. And this is at 4.703.
Yeah.
A contractor has an obligation to retain all of its records, right? It says, the contractor shall make available to the government all records, which includes books, documents, accounting procedures and practices, and other data, regardless of type, and regardless of whether such items are in written form, for 3 years after final payment. 3 years after final payment. Not after after completion, after final payment.
Right.
And Bill, your final payment may not occur for a significant amount of time after you've completed the contract, correct?
Yeah, for cost type contracts, you have to wait till DCA issues your final rate determination, and then you can start the closeout process. So it's many, many years. Although we're pretty good about this, we're pretty proactive. We are often, when we are able to close out contracts and start that clock ticking so that we can destroy those documents, Steve.
Now the government, the FAR Council tells contractors, so the 3 year rule is a general rule, but then it goes on to say for certain records, and it says see FAR Part 7.705 through 4.705-3, special rules,
yep,
whichever these periods expires first. Okay, whichever these, so if it's a 2 year rule, as opposed to the general 3 year rule, the 2 year rule documents can be destroyed. Can be destroyed after 2 years. The caveat, and Bill, this is where many government contractors fail. Notwithstanding the fact that you might be able to destroy records for less than 3 years, if a government contractor has a general policy that it keeps records for longer than 3 years, the contractor is obligated to keep the government contracting records for longer than 3 years.
Yes, we do 7 years, Steve.
So in your instance, Bill, if you have a policy that says all records must be kept for 7 years, the general 3 year rule goes out the window.
Right.
And any record retention less than 3 years also goes out the window. You have an obligation to keep all of your government contractor records for 7 years.
Right.
My recommendation has always been, and sometimes this is a challenge for contractors that do both commercial and government. Mm-hmm. What I will often say is set up a contractor retention policy that specifically addresses your government contract related documentation.
Right.
And follow the general rules that are set forth at 4.703. A is an alpha. 3 years, unless another rule at 4.705 says you can destroy it before 3 years. The reason being is the purpose for the general 3 years is for the government to have the opportunity to audit and review records. The general rule, as far as what your lawyers will tell you, is the less evidence that you might have, whether it's for you or against you, it's to some extent, the extent that they can be, you can remove them, it's probably to your advantage.
Yep.
Very rarely will you have a lawyer to say, keep those documents longer than what you need them for.
Yep.
And the government agrees, 3 years. We don't need it for more than 3 years. So if the government's saying they don't need it for more than 3 years, don't take on the additional liability for storing it for 7 years. Not say anything that what your company's doing is wrong, Bill.
Yeah, right.
But there's, again, the assumption of the risk, right, that there was 4 additional years, the government can come back, see some documentation, and grab money back because there's something in your records that says, oh, that was not allowable, or, oh, You didn't do this. We thought you were doing this. Now you're not. So 4.7 talks about contract and retention records. Mm-hmm. And Bill, if I was the FAR counsel for a day, mm-hmm. the next logical FAR part or FAR subpart would be what? After contractor retention requirements, government record retention requirements.
Yeah.
Right. So in my world, 4.8 should be what's in 4.4 FAR port 8.5, 805. I'd make it just a separate section. And with regard to contract government record retention policy, the magic period of time there is at 4.805, table 4.1. If you work on the government buy side, lays out all of your record retention policies. The longest period of time is 6 years.
Yep. 6 years after limitation.
Final payment, not completion of the contract.
Right.
After final payment. And it goes on to provide 7 other categories of documents that might have or have a different record retention policy.
Hey, Steve. So yeah. last week I was contacted by somebody from NASA who was trying to close out a contract that was 10 years old. So I was able to tell them that after the 6 years, the statute of limitations took effect. And we no longer had those documents available to them, and they still wanted me to sign a release. And I said, I don't have to. There's no reason to. And I couldn't even verify the information if I wanted to because I didn't have it anymore.
Right.
Yep. And then the other thing I think that your viewers might be interested in is, and this sometimes companies get tripped up on this, if you have subcontractors, you have to stay on top of those subcontractors to close out their contracts and give you releases. Because if you close out your contract without getting the subs, you run the risk, and this sometimes, very rarely, but it does happen, where they may come back and go, hey, we didn't invoice for this, or we didn't get paid for this, and we're now wanting you to pay us. We had that actually happen 2 years ago with one of our subs, and we ended up negotiating a settlement with them because we sent them a letter saying, you know, we're in the process of closing out your subcontract, and they just didn't respond. And so then we do that after 30 days, we send them another one, and we say, okay, now you have 2 weeks. And if we don't hear from you, then we're assuming that you have no other claims, and therefore your contract or subcontract is deemed closed. And they didn't like that, but they had a lot of turnover, and I think that's what happened. It just fell in the cracks. And it cost them $50,000.
I would say, Bill, we both know how hard it is with regard to government contract closeouts.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And it's interesting that when we take a look at 4.804, which talks about closeouts, it lays out specific time frames for when the government should close out the contract. Mm-hmm. I think by and large, none of those deadlines are being met.
Right.
There's still a backlog.
Yep, there is.
It is important for the government to close out contracts quickly and effectively because it allows you to de-obligate funds that are no longer needed for the existing contract.
Right.
And having additional funds is pretty important.
Yes.
I mean, there's a contracting officer that can quickly close out their contracts is a superstar because the agency now has dollars to use for other things to meet their mission. The longer it takes for a contract to be closed out, the longer dollars can't be spent for something else, notwithstanding the fact that the completion of the contract is over.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that's been asked for has been completed, but yet money is still under that contract. So contract closeout is very important. It's important for the contractor, Bill, because, of course, the sooner you can close out your contract, the sooner the clock starts ticking as to when the government could ask for money back.
Yep.
From the contractor. Mm-hmm. Contract closeout is critical. The important thing with regard to timing, where everything should start, and it should, from my point, Bill, it should be initiated by the contractor. The minute the contractor knows it has completed work, there should be a notice that's sent to the contracting officer.
Absolutely. Yep. Steve, and the other thing that you run into on cost type work is something that's called expiring funds. So you'll receive a notice from the government saying, hey, these funds are expiring in October. So you have to get your final invoice in there, because if you don't, then you go through another process called the DMAC process. And it's very, very painful, because what they have to do then, you'll go through DCMA and they will help you with this. They'll go back to the original government customer and say, you have this obligation that you have to pay, and you have to take it from, you know, current year money. And who wants to give up that? So we've had two contracts in the last 3 years that I've closed out through this DMAC process. And I would tell you, it's the most painful process I've ever seen with the closeouts. And, but in both cases, we were able to recover all the money we were owed, because the government caused the delay. They had a turnover in contracting staff. And, you know, once the contract's over, the contracting staff moves on to other things. And nobody really likes dealing with closeouts. So that's something that, if any of you have ever had to go through this DMAC process, my advice is, as soon as they send the expiring funds notice, get your finance people to kick it into high gear, because you don't want to go through this process.
Bill, the term of art, final invoice,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Why is that significant in the closeout process?
We do what's called a Z voucher, and that tells the government that that is your final invoice. Yep. And that's what they recognize.
Bill talked about closing subcontractors out before you close out with the government. That is incredibly critical. We've actually dealt with that together in the past successfully, thankfully. But it's a lessons learned. Make sure that you've got agreement from all of your subs that there are no further payments that are required under that subcontract. And have your subcontractors sign basically a hold harmless. We agree. There are no other liabilities that you have as a prime contractor to us under this subcontract.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to have a situation where you've closed out the government contract with your government customer, and then there is additional payments that need to be made for your subs, because then you don't have the federal source of funds for that. Right. And you certainly don't want to take it out of your profit.
Yeah.
And if we could do our second password right now.
Yep.
Yeah. So the second password of the day is movie, MOVIE. Movie. All right.
All right, Bill, let's jump into a topic that's near and dear to your heart. And reporting executive compensation.
Yes.
And first tier subcontract awards. That's found at FAR 4.14. But before we do that, Bill, I just want to say one quick thing about personal identity verification.
Okay.
And that's at 4.13. If you receive a solicitation or a contract that contains the personal identity verification clause in it, that's a heads up that the government presumes that your contractor employees will be working on a federal government site. Mm-hmm. And that has significance, Bill, especially on the cost under a cost reimbursement contract, because your your rates, more often than not, will be significantly different when you're working on a government site than when you're working on a contractor site, correct?
Sometimes, yeah, if you do that.
So it's important that you understand that you will be working at a federal site. It's important that you understand that your employees, more often than not, will be subject to certain federal government security requirements. It's important that you understand that your contractor employees will be using federal government IT equipment,
yep,
and telecommunications equipment, mm-hmm, which of course subjects them to audit and review,
yeah,
outside of the control of the contractor.
Yep.
Training your employees about working on a federal site is critical.
Oh yeah, it really is.
Because there are a host of I'll call them bad things that can happen.
Yes, very bad.
That can be avoidable by,
yeah,
by good training.
Yeah.
Including but not limited to, we're in the middle of March Madness, Bill. I'm not going to make any references to any particular company or client. But you need to make sure that your employees understand when they're working on a government site.
Yes.
And they're live streaming NCAA March Madness tournament games.
Yep.
That Big Brother is watching, and they know that, yep, your employees are doing that and will call into question whether they are actively working under your federal government contract.
Right.
And certainly will be aware when those timesheets come in as to how many hours that contractor employee might have billed for that day.
Yep.
The same thing with regard to using, back in the day, Bill, we had to deal with people who were going on to the auction sites and buying, yep, things on government property.
Yeah, Christmas shopping.
Christmas, yeah, shopping, right?
Yeah.
You need to also understand that if you have employees working on a government site, they might be subject to government closures, including when the government might be subject to a lockdown because the government's closed, whether it's for because of economics, whether it's because of weather. To the extent you can have agreement with the government that your contractor employees in those situations can work from the contractor site or even work from home, that is an important thing to have an agreement up front. Otherwise, there's, yep, a potential that you might lose revenue because your employees can't do anything else.
And Steve,
else on that, Bill?
Yeah, so our subcontracts include conduct of the subcontractor employees while working either our facility or even more importantly the government's facility. And some of them you would look at and go, well, yes, bringing a gun onto a government facility, that should be a no-brainer. But what we found is even the ones that are obvious, put it in the subcontract of and especially using government computers for personal business. So we sometimes give people a Bowhead laptop. So if they need to do something, work on a proposal or something while they're at the facility, they will use their own laptop and not be charging the government for working.
All right, Bill. Now let's talk about executive compensation and first tier subcontract award reporting.
Yes.
Briefly.
Yes.
Because we've got some other topics, okay, we need to get to.
Okay. So it basically breaks it down into three parts. The first one found at D1 is executive compensation of the prime contractor. So Bowhead has a few contracts that meet this criteria. And excuse me for reading this, but 80% or more of its annual gross revenues from the federal contracts and subcontracts, loans, grants, and subgrants, cooperative agreements, and other forms of financial assistance. That's the first criteria. And the second criteria is $25 million or more in annual gross revenues from federal contracts, subcontracts, loans, grants, and subgrants, cooperative agreements, and other federal financial assistance. So if you, if your company, as when you're the prime contractor, you have to go in and report the top five executives and their salaries, which includes bonuses and all sorts of whatever compensation they get. And so that's the requirement for the first top. And then the second one is then if you have a, like we do, we have our first tier subcontractors that would also qualify. We have to go into the FSRS system, which is Federal Funded Accounting and Transparency Act sub-award reporting system. Some people call it FFADA, so I don't call it that. But anyway, there's a guide at www.fsrs.gov that will show you how to go in the system and report the award of your first tier subcontractors. And when this first came out, maybe I think it was 7 years ago, people were very confused, and you'd often get companies would ask you to give them the top five executive salaries. And we would say, no, that's not the way you do it. We go into SAM and we go in and report this, the salaries there, and we've then complied with this act. And so, now I think, I don't know, do you have, Steve, a sample of what it looks like? Because I think I have a person that works in my compliance department, and we found for all of our contracts, it makes it much easier for her to one person to do it, because it's a skill set, you know, to go in the system, and not everybody can really figure it out. So we got one person who's a subject matter expert, and they go in and report what our subcontract administrators do. There's a template we created that requires them to provide, it's like seven different pieces of information, one being the value of the subcontract you're awarding. And it's if it's over $30,000, you have to report that. And you go in and report it in the system, and then you get a report back. And I don't know if you guys, Steve, if you have that. Yeah.
So with regard to value, now we haven't gotten to FAR Part 16 yet.
Yeah.
But with regard to value, let's presume it's you've got a time and materials or labor hour subcontract.
Mm-hmm.
What Good do you question. Put down as the dollar value?
So we tried to anticipate what the value is going to be for the first year of so if we set a ceiling at, you know, let's say $1 million, we go in and report it at that level.
Right.
Because if you incrementally fund your T&M, like a lot of people do in labor hour, you'd have to go back and keep updating and updating and updating. So we just decide that if the first year it's going to be $1 million subcontract, that's what we report. Doesn't necessarily mean that that's what they're going to get.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the price ceiling is correct. I think using your T&M or labor hour price ceiling is the proper way. The other interesting thing is with regard to subcontract, it's first tier award. Yes.
First tier, not second tier.
Below that. Right. So that your first tier subcontractor doesn't have obligations to collect information from lower tier subcontractors. The one of the things I always found fascinating, and I think it is indicative of the regulation bill, is the location of the subcontractor is required.
Yes.
And the reason for that is Congress or congressmen wanted to know potentially which jurisdiction, which representative district is benefiting from that subcontract.
Correct. For their voters.
The database allows the representative's office to know and to report out themselves, here are the dollars. Here's the federal government dollars that are being spent for my district.
Yep. That's exactly what it's for.
Okay. So again, it's an interesting reporting requirement. Bill, with regard to executive compensation, the prime contractors top five and first tier subcontract top five, right, that qualify.
Yep.
The major exemption is for companies that are publicly traded.
Correct. Yep.
And
because they already
for that is that information is required for a publicly traded company to tell shareholders and really to tell the world, this is where we're paying our top five. Again, Bill, from my perspective, it's a little bit of an overreach by the government to ask for this information from federal government contractors, but it's it was a political decision that was made. Again, really has no other purpose than to say, hey, this is what our government contractor contractors are paying their top people. And then the question is, well, what are they paying people at the lower end? So they can get this discrepancy. It's public information.
Steve, I will say this about this. This is, if you're going through a CPSR, this is a hot button. This is the latest thing that they've, the auditors have decided that they want to make sure that you're going in this FRS system, FSRS system, and reporting this. And what I then have them do is create a screenshot or a PDF of the reporting and put it in a special tab in our subcontract file, because that's, they're going to go through the file and they're going to look on that, and that's what they're looking for. They want to see that that report, the printout of it. Very important.
Absolutely, and I'm sure it's in your subcontractor policies that you do that.
Yes,
which is also important.
Yep.
Basic safeguarding of covered contractor information systems. 52.204-21 is required to be included in all acquisitions, including commercial items, other than off-the-shelf items, when a contractor information system may contain federal contract information. It's pretty all-inclusive, Bill.
Yeah.
If you're a federal government contractor, more often than not, this particular clause will be in your contract, and it's 52.204-21. And it has a significant number of requirements that need to be followed. 15 specific requirements. If you are new to the federal government contract business, it's important before you get awarded a contract with this clause in it that your IT department can say, yay, verily, yes, we can comply with those basic safeguarding requirements. And Bill, it has been fascinating since some of the new rules have come out. A lot of contractors didn't even know that this clause was even in their contract. Because a lot, the government was saying, it's not so burdensome if you're compliant with these. I'm like, oh my God, we had these compliance, these IT compliance requirements in our contract. They didn't even know. Because it's not, there's no small business exception. There's no commercial item exception. It needs to be done by any contractor that is going to have government contractor, federal contract information in it. And I'll be hard pressed, Bill, unless you're actually selling a product, you know, and there's no, there's no exchange of specifications or what have you, that you won't be subject to this rule.
Yeah, and Steve, what we did, we went to Microsoft GCC High, it's called, and that meets all the requirements for safeguarding information. So that was an, another move we made to make sure we were compliant with that requirement.
And then, of course, there, you know, the more added layer of security is a whole nother ball of wax. PCI actually has training. On the NIST 800-171 related requirements for sensitive but unclassified contract information that the government identifies. So if you want more on that, you can reach out to the good folks at PCI and have them set up for training, which I think there's actually gonna be some free training coming out soon. Let's jump into FAR Part 24, Bill, because we're coming down to the
And the right before, can I do the third, the final password right before that?
No. Let's do it. Let's do it at the end, 12:30.
Got it. Okay.
Okay. FAR Part 24 addresses two important things. One is the Privacy Act, and the other is the Freedom of Information Act. The Privacy Act really involves a very narrow type of contractor, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And it involves a contractor that will be working under a system of records.
Right.
That contains personal identifiable information of either the public or government employees. And the Privacy Act requires the government to follow certain responsibilities and certain compliance requirements before a government employee can have access to this personally identifiable information. The Privacy Act also says if a contractor is performing services for the government that will subject personally identifiable information, they also fit within the ambit of the statute. So it's not just government employees, it's also contractor employees.
Right.
Contractor employees that are required, that will have access to this special type of information, are required to train their people. My recommendation to a contractor who's going to have access to that information is to use the agency's training. The FAR Council states that if a contractor uses the agency's training, it's deemed to be compliant.
Mm-hmm.
If you use your own self-built training, it has to be approved by the government or the CO before it'll be deemed compliant.
Right.
It's easier to say, we have people who are going to be subject to these rules. Can we have access to government training to train our own employees? If you do that, you're safe and clear. But you need to tell your employees that if they violate these rules, they will be subject to criminal sanctions.
Right. Yeah, we do our own training.
We're talking about criminal fines and also potential imprisonment.
Yeah. So, Steve, we do annual training with all of our employees that have that work in classified programs. And I didn't realize you could ask for the government's training.
Well, this is Privacy Act training, Bill.
Okay, Privacy Act. Oh, gotcha. Okay.
So the last thing I want to talk about is the Freedom of Information Act. Is a very powerful tool. It's mostly often used by newspapers, but it can be used by contractors to obtain information about existing contracts that are ongoing. The government is required under the Freedom of Information Act to provide the public who asks for it access to government, access to information and copies at a reasonable cost. Mm-hmm. But there are exceptions. Mm-hmm. If classified information, if the documents requested contains contractor business or financial information,
mm-hmm.
if there's privacy information, if it reveals intergovernmental decision-making processes, those are all exempt. They can't be disclosed.
Mm-hmm.
For purposes of a government contract, a proposal that is not incorporated by reference into a contract is not subject to FOIA. That means a winning proposal that's not incorporated, and it also includes a losing proposal, will never be subject to FOIA.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
To ensure that you will not be subject to FOIA with regard to your proposal, that is incorporated into a contract, it is important that you identify every page of your proposal as subject to the B as in boy for exemption of the Freedom of Information Act. That's section B4 of FOIA. You also need to make sure that you can say yay verily that the information that you've shared with the government is held confidential by your company, meaning it's never shared with anyone who doesn't have a need to know of that information. At times, you might have to certify to an agency that would like to release your proposal information. You will have to provide a certification that you have kept that information confidential. It's always properly marked as confidential to your company. It's not shared with anyone within your company that doesn't have a need to know. And if it is shared with a third party, it's always subject to a non-disclosure agreement. And if you can demonstrate you've done those three things, then the government will state that is all that you need to do. Those new rules were subject to a very recent Supreme Court case. It's called Argus, A-R-G-U-S. It was part of the original source information we provided to you, because before the Supreme Court ruled that all you needed to do as a company is to prove that the information is kept confidential by you, you also had to demonstrate that not only do you keep it confidential, but if it released, it would cause you substantial harm, substantial competitive harm, which created a whole nother level of proof. That is no longer required. All you need to demonstrate is that when you submit it to the government, it was marked, that it's properly marked, that if you share it with another party, it's properly marked confidential and subject to a confidentiality agreement or non-disclosure agreement. And within your company, it's only shared with people who have a need to know. Yep. If you can do that, your proposals will not be subject to any disclosure under the Freedom of Information Act. At least they shouldn't. Right. If you find that the government has released information to the general public that they shouldn't, that's subject to a statute. And in that instance, a federal government employee could also be subject to criminal sanctions as well.
Yeah.
Bill, this takes us to the end of this episode of Fun with the FAR. Mm-hmm.
Hey, Steve, I wanted to say one more thing on that point. Our proposals, the cover page, and typically most of the pages are marked with a legend. It talks about it being procurement sensitive information and not to be disclosed outside the government. And, you know, sometimes the government hires contractors to participate in source evaluation group meetings, the SEG, and they have to sign non-disclosures that information that they're going to be exposed to, that they won't expose it. And sometimes it's our competitors, which makes me extremely nervous, because you know, you just have to trust that they're not going to do that. And we go through a very rigorous process to make sure when we have people who are working on the government site that are exposed to sensitive information, that they understand that they're not to disclose it with anybody else, even in our own company, right? They have right. to keep
so,
it.
So, Bill, you're following the rules I've established. You're following great best practices. Patrick, let's go with the password so people can sign off.
Yes, sounds good. Our final password of the day is principal, P-R-I-N-C-I-P-A-L, principal.
All right.
And I will also bring up our final ratings poll here for everyone.
All right, and until we see each other in 2 weeks, work hard, play fair, and go farther. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks again, Steve. Bill. See you later.